here at Fringe Central with Seamus Moran, who has a show called Have a Heart here at the Edinburgh Fringe. And I'm just going to read a line from the programme entry because it's so intriguing. A man who's recently had a heart transplant thinks that his new heart is talking to him. Is he going insane? Take it from there.
Take it from there. Well, this poor unfortunate man is DJ. His real name is Duggan, John Duggan, but in the heart character is called Ray. And in his head, the name gets twisted to Duggan John and then to D John. So he shortens it then to DJ. So DJ's had a heart transplant. He's sitting in the park relaxing. He starts to hear what he thinks are voices, but maybe it's the trees. Then the voice, this disembodied voice, gets closer and closer. And then before he realizes it, the voice has actually moved into his body and taken him over. And the only explanation he can get is that it's his new heart. So he does think he's going insane. He thinks maybe it's the side effects of the medication. But the heart assures him that it's not anything like that, that this is just the new reality and he's just got to accept it. So he reluctantly does, because his other option is that he's gone crazy. So he quickly discovers then that the reason this heart is talking to him is because just before he became available to be transplanted, he was a salesman. And when the audience come in, this is who they meet first.
We haven't got too many spoilers going on here, have we?
I'm trying my best not to give too many spoilers. But when they come in first, they meet Ray, who's this young, living in his head, executive. He's a regional sales manager. He's got a huge deal happening this weekend, but he's also supposed to be with his fiancée to announce their engagement to his parents-in-law, and it's her birthday. So he's completely fucked up. They have a huge row. She breaks it off. And then something very dramatic happens.
Which I'm not going to tell you
just yet. So that's why Ray ends up communicating as DJ's new heart. He ends up communicating with him, and he asks him to find his fiancée and just tell her that he loved her, he was an idiot, and he's sorry, and please forgive him. Simple. Except he's a heart, so he can't remember anything. He doesn't know her name, he doesn't know where she works, he doesn't know anything about her. So it becomes then a kind of a detective story, with DJ becoming using his head and Ray providing the intuition. So a combination of deduction and intuition, they do eventually find what they're looking for. But when they do, everything is not as it seems. And I can't give too much away on that score because there is a big twist. But there are clues throughout, because throughout the play there are voices coming in through a car radio. And again, it's explained why that's there. And these voices are giving not direct clues, but they're feeding extra information that the audience, if they build it up, by the time the twist comes, they should be just about reaching the same conclusion. So I think for the audience it's quite fun, because they get to be the detectives as well, and they're trying to figure out what's going on too.
So coming from the land of writers and the city of Dublin, I just want a picture. So was this a walk by the river? Was this a late night in a pub? Was this in a cafe when this idea was formed?
It was a combination of all of those things. Two things sparked it in particular. One was a conversation with my wife about organ donation, and we both thought, yes, it's a very good idea, but she said, under no circumstances to donate my eyes. And I couldn't understand. And she said, if somebody else got your eyes, I'd know it was you. And I said, surely not, because the eyes just reflect what's within. So that's what got me thinking about what happens when organs are transplanted. And there is a huge body of evidence that character traits, tastes, and personality traits are transplanted with organs. And so I was fascinated by that. And then the second thing that triggered was I read a fabulous book by Ian Banks, which is set on the Forth Road Bridge, which is very close to us here. And it's about an architect who crashes and ends up in this strange world that's an A-frame world similar to the bridge. And he's got to try and work his way out of this world. And that's kind of what's going on in this play as well. We're in a very strange world, and this man is trying to find his way out of it, or onto a better place, maybe.
I think it was W.B. Yeats who was a fan of Rudolf Steiner, the philosopher. That if you go back into the sort of, I guess, esoteric traditions, and you find that in the East too. I mean, we've got the word emotional intelligence, but they talk a lot about the unique nature of the heart and its ability to, you know, be the root of the human being, not the brain.
Yes, indeed. And you know, there are so many expressions that have the word heart in it to express how we're feeling or how things are. And there's a doctor in Ireland, psychiatrist, and I'm not going to be able to think of his name now, so I won't pause. It'll come to me. But he's done a lot of research in this area, and he's also investigated a lot of the Indian traditions. So he's come to two conclusions. The whole ethos of Indian religions is based around the heart being the core of everything that we do and are motivated to do. But he's also discovered through his research that scientists have discovered, I think it's a chromosome that is, what's the word? It's made in the brain, but it has a direct relationship with the heart. So so that's a fascinating area that I've only begun to dip into.
Yeah. And I guess I haven't read the script and I haven't seen it yet and hope to, but there's an obvious metaphor here for, you know, just what happens when we take on someone else.
Yes. For me, it's about a struggle, in this case, between two characters for the one body. But the two characters could be just two sides of the same person. And DJ is very much a man who has lived by the head. He's built himself into a very, very secluded world. He's kept to himself, and that's in danger of happening maybe to Ray if he doesn't go with his heart, if he follows his head instead of his heart. So as well as a struggle between two characters, it's also a struggle between the head and the heart and which to follow. And they kind of understandably go with the head initially because they're trying to figure out what's going on. But then at a certain point, DJ begins to figure out that actually we're doing this the wrong way around. He says, I'm just the divining rod, you're the diviner, so I've got to follow you.
Right.
And then it turns into a little bit of a roller coaster then, a little bit of a kaleidoscope. So logic goes out the window now and we're just following intuition. And that's where it gets a little bit freaky, I think, for the audience. But if they go with it, it's a bit of fun. And if they see it just as a bit of fun, it does lead somewhere that's worthwhile.
So head and heart, now I feel like we're sort of, in a good way, moving away just from brain researchers into, you know, Mary Coughlan and, you know, I would rather go blind than see you walking away from me. So this play deals with some really important issues. And there's a story here too. I'm still talking to the writer here for a moment. So how did this get written? Was this written in one go? Did you form it, do a bit more research? Did you test it out on other writers, other friends? How did this arrive as a script that you looked at and goes, right, I'm ready to get that into the rehearsal room?
Very good question. It took quite a while. It was written first as a radio play because to me that seemed the obvious medium because it's about a voice in a head. And so I did two drafts of that, two different drafts, and it just wasn't working. So I left it, ran away from it, said I never want to see it again.
Okay. And then before you go on, just tell us about what happens when you leave something.
There's a bit of sadness, obviously, but you just kind of have to forget about it and get on with things. And you sort of have to say, if it's any good, it'll come back. If it doesn't, then it's not been worthwhile. Yeah. And I got on with other things. I'm an actor, so I got on with trying to make a living as well and write other things. And then I went to see, in the Galway Fringe Festival, I went to see Enda Walsh's play, Penelope. He's here with a crazy musical this year, which I'm looking forward to seeing. And my breath was taken away because of the physicality of it, and I'd forgotten about the physicality of theatre and what you can show in theatre that you can't show in any other media. Because if you take the audience with you, they'll go anywhere you want, and you can actually stretch their imagination even more than radio can. And so that got me thinking again about the play. And I also saw Silent by Pat Kinavan. Pat is here this year with Underneath, another one-man show, and Silent just blew me away, and I just said I want to do something in that direction.
So seeing the potential of some solo shows actually lit the fire again under yours?
Yes, absolutely. And so that's what drove me back to it. And I did a further two drafts to try and cut it down, because if it's a solo show, you don't want it to be 2 hours long.
Can I just stop you again? So you decided to go back to it.
Yes.
And then you pick up this old script. I just want you to go into those moments for me.
Yes, you pick up this old... First of all, you have to find where you dumped it. It's usually, for me, it's usually in a brown envelope. And then I've got this box that I put them all into. So you get through all the dust and you get distracted by one or two others as you go, oh, yeah, I remember that one. Yeah. Yeah, maybe I'll go back to that tomorrow. So it's hard to focus. You say, no, this is the one I want to do now. So eventually you find it, take it out of the envelope, you read it. Sometimes, and I think I remember in this case, sometimes what happens is you then realize why it didn't work before, because you see now some of the not so good writing that you didn't see before when you thought everything was wonderful.
But also, as a writer, do you remember, do you think the decision to go with it again had already been made before you took it out, or did the reading of it confirm it?
I think the decision had been made beforehand, because I think the biggest decision to make was that now I was going to look at it as a stage play, as a one-man show, which now made more sense than the radio, because it wasn't about a voice and a head.
Yeah.
It was about this struggle for this one body between these two characters.
Yeah.
And that's where the fun of it is in playing, and the fun for the audience, because you literally have these... The body keeps changing completely from one person to the other, like in an instant. So that decision had been made, definitely, when I went back to it. So then it was a question of trying to get the core of the story clear and get rid of all the extraneous, particularly characters, because, you know, if it's a one-man show, it's nice to have lots of different characters, but at the same time, you don't want them just popping up for no good reason.
And when you did pick it up and start reading it, I mean, you obviously put new eyes on the script, and new eyes means, had you changed?
Had I changed? I had, yeah. It was three, it could have even been 4 years. Lots of things had changed. I had done television for 12 years. I was in a soap in Ireland and got stuck into all that entails. And while I'd still done theatre, you kind of drift away from it a little bit. You get a little bit, not lazy, but, you know, you forget how much effort is required to put on a theatre show compared to just going in and doing a few scenes on a TV show. So that had changed. I was older now. I was approaching 50, whereas originally when I started looking at it first, I was only around 40. And in some ways, 50 seemed like a better age for the DJ character, because it's a point, I don't know, I can't remember the writer, who said that the man you are at 45 is the man, that's it, that's what you're going to be. I'm not sure about 45, but definitely 50, that's it, you know. Not a huge amount is going to change after that. So it's difficult to come to terms with that, or I found it difficult anyway. So I think writing this kind of helped a little bit. So maybe there was a little bit of self-therapy going on.
Well, do you think maybe even your sort of hidden genius kind of put it away for now?
My hidden genius?
Yeah, you know, you put it away and then you came back to it, and now is the right time.
Well, if I believe what's happening in the play, then yes, I would have to believe that's what happened. That wasn't the time to do it, and now was the time. And certainly in terms of the response and the way certain things fell into place. For example, I was able to get a really good director that I've worked with a number of times, Liam Halligan, and he's a terrific, they call him dramaturges now, but he's just really good at paring things down and not just cutting stuff to make it shorter, although we did joke about how light it should be when it was finished, how many grams it should weigh, rather than even how many pages. No, he was terrific to have, and he wouldn't have been available maybe 5-6 years ago in the way that he was now.
Okay. We won't get too mystical, but it does feel like this was the right time.
I think so. Yeah, definitely. Okay.
And so then this dusty script comes out, and then what happens?
Then a lot of hours is spent usually on a computer, just tapping away and trying to figure out how is this going to work and how much... I suppose for me, I wanted the audience to be just maybe slightly behind, but not so far behind that they'd just get lost and fed up. So I was probably giving too much information because I didn't want them to get completely confused. And that's, I think, what Liam was able to pare back, because he was able to come to it as an audience and say, well, I see where you're going with this, so I don't need that extraneous information there. Yeah. But it wasn't easy. We spent about maybe 6-8 months to-ing and fro-ing to get it cut, and we got it down to about two-thirds of what I had written originally, and then we went into rehearsals with it, and we got it down to about half what it was going into rehearsals, and that's what we have now, and it's all the better for it. It's really clear, it's concise, and like I say, it's just the audience get just enough information to keep up, but not to get that they're not going to get bored.
And that audience, I mean, even with 5 years going by, transplants are that much more just normal, aren't they? So I guess that might just change the context around it.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. It is, yeah. I won't go into the documentary I saw about China, where it's become so normal you can actually buy a transplant now. Apparently they're using Falun Gong members to provide the hardware. But I suppose it has changed. I haven't really given that any thought. Maybe it's changed in the sense that when you get an audience and you're trying to suspend their disbelief, you know, lots of people have heart transplants. A lot of people are aware now of the research that when I researched first, I found not many people knew that there was this phenomenon of memory transfer with your organs, whereas now it's quite well known, and most people I've mentioned it to have at least gone, oh, yeah, I've heard that, yeah. Mm. And so that, because I think that adds a lovely, intriguing dimension to the play, and it's certainly something I've had a lot of fun with, and the characters have a bit of fun with it.
Yeah. And I guess my tongue-in-cheek question here is, you know, looking at the image also, which is a lovely image for the piece, how do the writer and the actor get on with each other?
We've had a very good relationship with each other, actually. Sometimes with the director, it was quite fun, because if things were going badly for the writer, then the actor could step in and sort of be like a mediator between the writer and the director. And then other times when the director was giving the actor a hard time because he wasn't doing what he wanted him to do, then the writer could come in and say, look, he's a good actor, give him time, he'll get there. And then sometimes when the actor was really pissed off, he would be DJ and he'd blame Ray, and he'd ask the director to talk to Ray instead of to DJ, because DJ was tired and he needed to rest. Because it's quite full on when you're stuck in a rehearsal room with the director for 8 hours a day. So sometimes I had to pass him over to Ray, but then Ray quite frequently passed him back to DJ again. So.
And now you're here. I mean, is the writer not here?
I think he's going home today. He certainly wasn't in this morning, and it was the best show that I've done so far. So that was a huge help. He's been around the last 3 days. Understandably, I had a new operator, so he needed to be there to make sure that all the cues were in the right place and everything. So it was nice to do a show this morning without him around, and the director hasn't been here, so I felt very free this morning. Yeah.
And now, as you do quite, you know, an extended run over the month, I guess you become aware of the venue, you become aware of the audience. What's that telling you?
It varies from show to show. I mean, yesterday I had my biggest house, but yet I found myself asking my techie and my writer at the end, did they get it? Because, you know, you're always, as an actor, you're trying to sense how it's coming across. Are you going too fast? Do they understand your accent? Are they getting the little jokes that are there? Mind you, I didn't help because I'd messed up, I think, 3 of my gags by just getting them the wrong way around, which was so bad. So that was yesterday. But then today, with a smaller audience, I just knew from the minute they were tuned in, from the minute I started, pretty much, I knew they were tuned in. Now, again, maybe that's because I was a bit freer. The writer wasn't there. And it was just, there was no doubt at the end. I mean, they stood at the end and we shouted at each other. I said, thank you very much. And they said, no, thank you very much. So that's that's going to change, I think, maybe every day. But I suppose what was great about today was it restored my belief in the show, because, you know, there's a short period when I'm up there and I'm talking to myself as two different people. And there's a risk of that seeming very odd and very strange, and maybe you should call for guys in white coats.
Well, let me end with an odd question then. The final question is, if we could go back to when the version of you that said, I'm going to put this away, whenever that was, a few years back, if that person wandered in and sat in the back row and watched this as it is now and then came up to you afterwards, what do you think you would say to you?
I think I'd say, fair fucks. That's not bad. I didn't think you could do it, but you have.
Great bit of affirmation from you to you there. So, Seamus, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Paul.